the train pulls up, and stepping out from the train is Maharaji named Krolli Baba. And he steps off, you know, down the couple of stairs, and he opens up his blanket, because he was always wrapped up in a woolen blanket. He opened up his blanket in his arms, and he wrapped his blanket in his arms around me. And mm-hmm. and he was weeping, and I was weeping, and he was saying, "Finally, you've come home. Finally, you've come back. Finally, you've come back."
So welcome to this episode. Today is going to be another English episode. So I hope, even if you are a regular listener and you're used to German podcasts, that you still stay and listen to this wonderful chat that I'm going to have with one of the most amazing kirtan and mantra singers that we have, which is Jai Uta. Welcome, Jai. Thank you for being on this show today.
Thank you so much, Maritz, for inviting me to the show today. Appreciate it.
Yes, thank you for taking the time. And I would love to talk with you about, how did you get into singing kirtan? You know, what's the history? How has it changed maybe over time for yourself? And also in the yoga scene, is it even related always to yoga? Is it separate from yoga? So we're going to touch on these different topics, and I'm sure some other topics that I haven't thought of right now. And before we get going, I already want to say Jai is coming on to a tour throughout the US, of course, but also in Europe. So you will find him in a city near you, and we're going to link everything below this podcast, also Jai's website and Instagram, so you have all the information right there, so you don't have to take any notes, and you can just listen and enjoy. So for those of you who don't know who Jai Uttal is, as I said, he is a renowned kirtan singer, music producer, multi-instrumentalist, and just a wonderful, wonderful human being. I have met Jai, I think the very first time, I don't think Jai remembers, but I have seen him sing in Berlin at a studio called Spirit Yoga, and it must be like a very, very long time ago that this has happened.
15 years, maybe, do you think?
Probably, at least 15, yes.
At least 15 years. Yeah, and I remember Spirit Yoga very well. And, you know, Berlin is amazing, of course.
It is amazing. And, I mean, you have done so much. And another connection that we have is through our dear friend and my dear teacher, Sharon Padma Gannon.
One of my best friends.
Exactly. And I love that we have that connection. And through her, I mean, she is good in bringing people together and connecting people. And I just love her for making connections sometimes where maybe no one has ever seen a connection before, maybe human beings, other beings, or thoughts even that she shares with the world. So we have that connection, although we haven't met in person many times. I think another time at one of those Omega great kirtan and mantra festivals that they have.
Yeah.
And so lovely to have you. And I'm already looking forward also having you in Berlin in May 2026. So why don't you give us a little bit of a background on how did you get into the whole world of kirtan, mantra, singing? Or maybe let's start a little earlier. How did you get into music to begin with?
Wow, Maritz, it's a long story. My father was in the music business. And, you know, he was a producer. And, you know, every week he would bring home the 45s, this is a long time ago, the top 20 singles from the radio. And he'd ask my sister and myself our opinions of the songs. And, you know, because he wanted the young people's thoughts. And then the house was always filled with music. I started studying piano, I guess when I was around 7 or something like that. Classical piano, but I didn't like it. I I don't even remember why I didn't like it. Perhaps it was the teacher, but after 2 or 3 years, I stopped and you know, pretty much felt like, okay, I'm not that interested in music anymore. And then a very amazing thing happened. I made a friend who played banjo, five string banjo, and he loaned me his banjo, and oh my God, it was an entirely new experience of music. I strummed those strings, and I felt the sense of peace, the sense of safety that I had never felt before. So I dived into it. And this is like old-timey, hillbilly, Appalachian music, which, you know, in retrospect, I really feel there's so many connections between that and the passionate, passionate singing of kirtan. You know, there was a desperation of the people who created that music, and, you know, poverty and, oh, so many things. And so I was first connected to that anguished singing, but I wasn't singing much. You know, I was more playing, and because I was very shy about my singing. And anyway, time went on. I went to high school, music high school, and, you know, learned much, much more about music and theory and stuff. And then when I graduated from high school, I decided I wanted to go to college in Portland, Oregon, that the farthest away from New York. I wanted to get as far away from New York as I could. I grew up in New York City. And the evening before my first college class, Ali Akbar Khan, the greatest master of classical Indian music, gave a concert. And, well, I took mescaline before the concert. And so we people know, you know, that you have experiences with drugs and it's a great experience, but you forget about it the next day. It's gone. But anyway, so I listened to this music, this concert, and I was so completely blown out by it. And when it was over and Ali Akbar Khan got off the stage and the tabla player got off the stage, I was hearing the music didn't end. And the sound of everybody's voices was the continuation of the raga, and the sound of the people's footsteps was the continuation of the tabla beats. And even to the extent where somebody came up to me and said, "Hey, it's over, let's go." And I said, "No, it's not over, it's not over." And I felt that this music was the closest music to the life force. So I went to college for one semester, failed music, failed religion, and went down to California and began studying with Ali Akbar Khan, classical Indian music. I played an instrument called the sarod. It's a 25-string instrument. I don't play it anymore, but I studied that. And then a breakthrough came because Ali Akbar Khan demanded that anyone who studied with him, whether it was guitar or sarod or sitar or tabla, anybody who studied with him had to also study Indian singing. Mm. I wasn't keen on it, you know, but you know, he's my teacher, and I said, okay. And because they had a singing class, you know, where they would teach the ragas in a vocal form. And so I started going to that class, and you know, I was so shy that in order to practice my singing, I would have to make sure none of my housemates were there. And I'd even look out the window and make sure that the neighbor's car wasn't there. But so I started singing, and I began to have this experience of, it's really hard to describe, but this, suddenly I entered into my inner world, and I was still a teenager, and I didn't know that inner world existed. So meanwhile, and this is actually before I went to California, I was at a big gathering in Central Park in New York. It was called the Human Be-In. And you know, it was a big celebration of psychedelic culture, et cetera, et cetera. And I went there, and that's that's just when the Hare Krishna movement had just come into New York City. So I was quite entranced by them. Not that I wanted to join, but there was something about the repetitive singing and drumming and mantra chanting that was new to me. And I really was attracted to it. So I followed them around a bit in New York. The culture of it didn't appeal to me. So I never, wanted to explore joining them. But I went to the kirtans a bunch, and they did a lot of kirtan outside, because that's also part of their thing is proselytizing. So, which I was not interested, but I loved listening to it. So anyway, backtracking again. So then I was in California, and while I was studying with Alaya Prakam, a yoga teacher, a guy from India, who was representing a yoga organization in India, came to California to teach. And I really liked this Indian. He was a Swami. I really liked him. And so I started going to the yoga classes, and he taught us, a bunch of us, meaning the handful of young people, a bunch of beautiful kirtan mantras, and we would sing them, and it was very joyful, and the experience of group singing, where your kind of your individual voice merges with the big voice of the group, was revelatory for me. It was just I could sing and not be self-conscious,
right?
Nobody was leading it, and it was just so fun and so exhilarating, and just great. So I was already deeply into Indian music, as well as just deeply into music, and this is when the seed of like mantra singing get kind of really planted. So after a couple of years, I decided I wanted to go to India to meet the guru of this Swami. Mm-hmm. And, there's a long story there, and I'm going to just not really go into it. But I had met Ram Dass in America and had read his first book, Be Here Now. And I was, I was very moved by it. It's a very, his story and how he went to India and met his guru. It was very moving. Well, I don't know if you've read it, but it was a very influential book. But I was not going to see that guru. I really liked Ram Dass when I met him. But it wasn't in my plans. I was going to see the guru of the Swami. So I get to India, I went with my two oldest friends and my girlfriend at the time and the girlfriend of one of these friends. And although I'm not in touch with the girlfriends, the two oldest friends, and this was, 1971, I guess, are still my closest friends. So, and one of them, Charlie, was my friend from high school. So it's really amazing to have old friends. I'm almost 75, and these guys have been my dear friends for all those decades. I know it's off the subject a little bit, but I think that deep friendships are one of the jewels of life, one of the great gifts of life. Anyway, so we arrived in New Delhi, and a friend from California who had gone a couple of weeks earlier also to see this guru met us at the airport. We didn't know how he knew we were coming. He said he had a dream about it, and he told us that the guru was in jail for murder. And again, that's a big story, Moritz. But so our agenda was basically cut, and we were wandering around a little bit, and 5 days later we were in Vrindavan, this holy town to Radha and Krishna. And we were sitting at the feet of Neem Karoli Baba, and who we call Maharaji. Now, I have to say that it wasn't for me, you know, after this experience with that first guru, it wasn't like I was rushing to have a guru. You know, I didn't want a guru anymore. I felt like, okay, I'm 19 years old and I've had the guru experience.
Right. Maybe.
Enough, you know? But being with him, again, to make a long story very short, I would say gradually he cracked my heart open.
Yeah.
And the soundtrack to this completely life-changing meeting was kirtan. And in his temple, there were in Vrindavan, there was 24-hour kirtan going on. And in the town of Vrindavan, it still is, but in those days, it was very pristine. I mean, it's not pristine now, but it's still very, like, sacred. But in those days, it was very pristine. You could walk barefoot everywhere, and mm-hmm. every other house was a temple, and each temple had a microphone and like some funky loudspeakers on top. So you walk around there, and you're kind of like bathing in these sacred mm-hmm. sound vibrations. The singers in Maharaji's temple were unbelievably exquisite. The melodies that they sang, and it was really just a man and a woman, a harmonium and a dholak, which is a two-sided drum. Mm-hmm. You know, so it wasn't a big group or anything. And the mantra that they sang was Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare. So this music, these mantras and this music, you know, first I'll say they were, it was coming into my ears during this whole transformative time. But then I say it was coming into my molecules, not just, you know, my whole being was absorbing this, devotion. Well, devotion is a, you know, it's a difficult word to translate. So I'll say emotion. Let's say this emotion directed to spirit. The singing was so poignant and so painfully blissful, if that mm-hmm. makes any sense. So anyway, you know, then there came a point where one day I got to the temple in the morning. You know, I was there very early every day, and I got to I pranamed to Hanuman because it's the Hanuman temple,
right.
And then I went to the gate that goes to the back courtyard, and back I should say in those days the back courtyard was just dirt, and you know, in the middle of the courtyard there was a very low wooden table with a rough blanket on it, and that very rustic scene, that was, oops, I knocked my computer, that was Maharaji's throne in a way. Mm-hmm. But it, you know, it couldn't have been more simple, more funky, less it couldn't, you know, less glamorous or less royal. You know how some gurus come in a, you know,
right.
a golden throne or something like that. It was the absolute opposite of that. Well, anyway, so this day I got there, and the guard at the gate to the back area said I couldn't come in. And I asked him why. And he said, I said, you know, every day I've been coming to sit with Maharaji. Why can't I come today? And he said, Maharaji left last night. Oh, I said, oh, wow, where did he go? And he said, we don't know. And he was kind of harsh, you know. And I said, well, when is he coming back? He didn't say. And so I you know, my heart broke. You know, I hadn't really realized how attached I had become, to him. Mm-hmm. So I went to Benares, Varanasi, and got a little house outside of the city in the mustard fields. This is a very, very beautiful little place. And I was going into the city every day to take music lessons with a teacher from the Benares Hindu University. And so that was very beautiful. And the temples in Benares, I should say Varanasi, because that's what it's called now. The temples in Varanasi were very, very ancient and very potent. You know, even though Varanasi was a little too crowded for me to be really comfortable, but I would go sit in the temples and listen to this chanting that was, it felt like from ancient times. And, you know, it's like each new place in India that I went to and experienced the chanting that was going on there, it was always different, and every place it was different, but each new place felt like kind of another initiation in, I shouldn't use, maybe that's too pretentious to say, but a deepening of my experience of what Kirtan was. And then I and my two friends that I was traveling with got the word that Maharaji was going to be in Allahabad, the city in North India, at a such and such date. He was going to be staying with an Indian family there. So, you know, I got to Allahabad, and I got sick. It was kind of my first round of Indian tummy.
Right. Yeah.
And also, my girlfriend decided that she fell in love with another guy, so that was a little depressing. And they were both. And also, I didn't have any money, and I didn't really know where to stay. So I wound up sleeping in the corner of an apartment, upstairs apartment, with some Australian hippies who I didn't know and didn't relate to or anything. And so it was really, and every day I would go to this house where Maharaji was expected, but he wasn't there. It was kind of, am I getting too off the subject, Moritz?
No, I mean, you're such a great storyteller. I love to listen, and I think it is very exciting just for also listening to those different occasions, as you said, like different surroundings. And most of them, from what I hear, weren't even your maybe favorite surroundings, either location-wise or the setting, or, you know, so many obstacles could have been there looking from the outside. But then the music and the kirtan and the mantra was really the thing, as you said, the soundtrack almost of that whole journey that carried you on and carried you further to the next step and a deeper layer of things. I'm curious to hear then, when was the point when you felt, because that was mostly, it seemed like your own practice, right? You were learning, you were studying, of course, you were joining and singing yourself. But when came the point where you felt, I want to share that with others? Or did that even happen and how?
Okay. And let me just quick finish what I was saying, and then I will jump ahead to that. So, you know, it was one of those periods where I was thinking, like, why did I even come to India? I was so depressed, you know? And then one night, I went to sleep, and I had this dream, it felt like not a dream. It was, you know, I was sleeping. And in the dream, I was in the Allahabad train station. It was completely empty. And I was waiting for the train to come. And I didn't know why I was waiting or why I was even there. But I was waiting. And then finally, the train comes into the station. And, you know, it was completely deserted, the whole place, which obviously, if anybody's been to Indian train stations, it was a dream. But anyway, so the train pulls up, and stepping out from the train is Maharaji, named Krolli Baba. And he steps off, you know, down the couple of stairs, and he opens up his blanket, because he was always wrapped up in a woolen blanket. He opened up his blanket in his arms, and he wrapped his blanket in his arms around me. And he was weeping, and I was weeping, and he was saying, finally you've come home, finally you've come back, finally you've come back. And in that dream, I realized that Maharaji had been my savior and my protector lifetimes after lifetimes. Mm-hmm. And I woke up and I was really in an altered state. I looked at the clock. It says it was like 1:20 in the morning. So I went back to sleep. And the next morning, I walked over once again to the house where Maharaji had been expected. And the energy was a little different. People were, you know, moving around with a lot of much more focus, I guess you could say. And I asked a young Indian man, what's going on? And he said to me, well, Maharaji arrived last night by himself in the Allahabad station at 1:20, and he called us to pick him up. And, you know, the dream, when I woke up from that dream, I knew. But I also know myself that over decades, I might have questioned that, right? Mm-hmm. But the fact that it's actually what happened, you know, in not dream life,
right,
kind of sealed what I had, you know, experienced in the dream. All right, so fast forward, I get back to America. I'm scrambling around trying to figure out a job, and I went back to continuing studying Indian classical music with Ali Akbar Khan. And I was singing kirtan with friends and by myself and singing prayers and mantras. It was kind of like my private life, you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. In my public life, I got a job in a restaurant. I also became the electric guitarist in a reggae band, a Jamaican reggae band that was touring around. It was a great experience. I was the only non-Jamaican guy, and then I was working in a covers band after a little while, you know, working as a musician. But privately, I was singing my kirtans. But I was still shy about my singing. So mostly, you know, in these bands, I was playing electric guitar. And I was, you know, I was very deep into that. I loved that. I still love that. But I wasn't singing, and these bands weren't necessarily spiritual music. They were my jobs. And I, you know, I was a young musician, and what better to have a job making music rather than doing something else? Well, a little time passed, and I had been getting together with friends once a week, and we were having these wonderful big old kirtans in friends' house, and still nobody was really leading. And, you know, one person would say, okay, let's do this chant, you know, and then we would all do that for a while, and then let's do this chant. And it was fantastic times, you know. We were exploring that practice in our own way. And then I started to get calls from people around the area in California. Would you come and lead a kirtan with us and teach us a little bit about kirtan? And I was very shy about it. First of all, I was not, you know, I didn't feel like, I didn't like my voice, put it that way. And secondly, the last thing I wanted to do was to pose myself as a spiritual teacher because,
right,
you know, I'm just a struggling person, you know. But that being said, I didn't say no to these invitations. And I went, and really, mostly it was beautiful, you know. And so I was doing that. And then I made my first album, which is mostly instrumental music. And it was, you know, I was really exploring, like I was kind of a scientist, right? Exploring Indian instruments and Indian melodies and trying to put them with Western and synth and guitar and stuff. Mm-hmm. The album was called Footprints. And I did on one song, the great Indian singer Lakshmi Shankar sang it with me. And it was only, I only sang on two songs of the album. And that was one of them. And it was, of course, the mantra Raghupati Raghava Raja Ram, but with my own melody. And I needed to put a band together to promote the album. I didn't need to. I wanted to. The album, which I thought, you know, was just going to be put it into the ethers. No one is ever going to listen. It became this top 10. They used to have international world music charts. I don't think they exist anymore. Mm-hmm. Maybe they do. But it went to number one in Germany. It got a lot of attention. And so I wanted to put a band together. And gradually that band turned into what I call the Pagan Love Orchestra. And the Pagan Love Orchestra, and we did a bunch of other albums as the band, and you know, in a slightly different form. I have a gig with Pagan Love Orchestra next week. We don't, you know, most of the time my gigs aren't with such a big ensemble, but for so many reasons, you know. But like twice a year, maybe we do it. And I love it so much. And it was really a mixture. It was like such a ecstatic mixture of kirtan, reggae, rock, jazz, a little bit. I would pull out my banjo and play some Appalachian music. We had some things that were almost Middle Eastern sounding. And you know, the band had a trombone. At that time, the band had a trombone, violin, electric guitar, not me. Well, I played also electric guitar and harmonium, but another like great guitarist was playing. We had electric bass, we had drums, percussion, and a couple of extra singers. So it was a big production. And man, it was so much fun. And every gig, at that time we did a lot of gigs, and you know, we even went to Europe, and every gig was this complete cathartic experience for me.
Mm-hmm.
So, and then with some conflict with the record company and stuff, I was not able to hold the band together. It was like, hey, everybody, there's no money anymore. I don't want to break up us. And I love you guys. So it wasn't like a band that fell apart because of bad vibes. I love you, each and every one of you. I love so much and respect. So let's just put this on the back burner a little. And when opportunity arises, we'll play together again. And that's basically how
what happened. Started. Yeah.
But then, because I couldn't finance the band anymore, I decided to just do as many. Well, also at the same time, a couple of things happened, big things for me. One was that I got sober, because I had been drinking, I'd been using drugs. What started out as allies turned out to be enemies in a way, you know what I mean? So it was a process. I got sober, and all these things kind of happened at the same time. The other thing that happened is that yoga studios began to open their spaces for music. Mm-hmm. It hadn't been, you know?
Right.
And suddenly here was this, all these venues where there wasn't smoking, where there wasn't drinking. And at the time, I won't say that everybody was excited about kirtan. It was really new, but there was always some that were like really wanted to experience it, feel it. And the other thing that happened at that time is I met my soulmate and Nubia, who you know now. And yeah. I never believed in soulmates. I never believed that the possibility of a relationship, you know, everything in me was like, okay, my relationship with God is what's important. Mm-hmm. Everybody in the human plane is going to fail me. Yeah. But it's, you know, kind of a little dark, right? But I met Nubia and I got sober. And with Nubia, I felt finally like safe enough to express how scared I was. Mm-hmm. And then I started doing a lot of kirtan all around the place with just me. At the time, I was playing with my old friend Daniel Paul, who now lives in Hawaii. He played tablas. Was it Daniel with me when I was at Spirit Yoga? I think it might have been.
I mean, I've definitely seen Daniel a couple of times. I don't know if he was there in Berlin, but yeah, if you were touring with him, then it might have been him.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure it was. And we did so much kirtan in so many different places. And you know, at first, four or five people would come, and then 11 people would come. And very, very gradually, you know, these were small rooms. It wasn't like I was
right.
in the
yeah. Yeah, hall, yeah,
but,
yeah.
But gradually the rooms would become packed with people. And you know, you mentioned Sharon before. She invited me a bunch of times to New York to mm-hmm. do it. And she was such a fan and a friend and a supporter. So every time I came there, she made sure that the room was packed. And still, this was before there wasn't really anybody else doing it. I would say after a few years, Krishnadas began to do some kirtan, and I actually produced his first album for him, uh-huh. Or with him, I guess you could say. But kirtan was not
like popular. Yeah.
Popular, but somehow or another, I was, this is all I wanted to do. And I still was shy about singing, but I realized that there was something in me arose at one point. It was like sing or die, but it wasn't right. like literally die, but it was like on the soul level, if you don't sing, I'm talking to myself, if you don't sing something, this is going to wither out, because you know, I could say this is my therapy, I could say put it in so many different ways, but it was the healing balm of my heart, which was very wounded, you know, like so many of us, you know, and the singing is what held it together and slowly, you know, slowly turned me into a full person. Somewhere in there also, I guess it was three or four years after Nubi and I were together, we had our baby. And I never thought I was going to be a father. It was our son, Ezra Gopal. I thought I was ill-equipped emotionally to be a father. Mm-hmm. But it turned out to be he turned out to be the biggest blessing in my life, and fatherhood became the biggest blessing in my life. And lo and behold, I had a little audience there that I could sing kirtan to in a very, mm-hmm. very, very tender, different way. And I sang to Ezra, I sang to him so much, you know. And then when he got a little bit bigger, when he would sit on my lap when I would play harmonium, and he would, you know, his back, his head would, he would like lean back on my chest. And for 3 hours, you know, he would just be there still. And this brought a whole nother level of bhakti, and also of this feeling of like service, because I came to the idea of service slowly, because at first it was like I was healing myself, you know, and other people would tell me how meaningful it was, but it would just go like that over my head, you know. Ezra, suddenly there was someone who was more important than me, right? And I just wanted to take care of him. Anyway, you know, time went on, and kirtan became a little bit more popular. And chronologically, it's hard to remember exactly, but one time I came home from a gig, from a bunch of gigs, and I was tired, you know. And Nubia says to me, Jai, why are you going all over the country to these places, offering your kirtan and not making much money and coming back exhausted? I said, well, what are my options? And she said, well, let's do our own kirtan camp. Mm-hmm. And I thought, who would come? You don't know who's going to come. And she said, well, let's give it a shot. And so we arranged for a place, non-residential. The first one was non-residential, mm-hmm. and it was in town. And wow, people were signing up inside. You know, a whole bunch of people signed up. And we did a 10-day kirtan camp. And, you know, at first I was like, well, okay, they signed up. What am I going to teach? And, right. You know, I made a long list. Nubia gave me a blank notebook. I made a long list of everything I wanted to cover the first day. And by the end of the day, I had only, you know, covered three things. And I realized that, okay, yeah, I'm the teacher, you could say, of this. Mm-hmm. But that everybody who came was a teacher, and everybody came with, you know, wanting their heart to be healed, their heart to be opened. Everybody came with their own invisible angels and invisible gurus and, you know, guides that accompany them in life. That might sound kind of trippy, but I feel that to be true. And I realized that, well, all these gurus and my guru and all these, they were the leaders of the retreat, you know, mm-hmm. and it was so beautiful. And so a bunch of very well-known people who are now very well-known kirtan singers were there. Govindas, mm-hmm. I don't know if you know, in California, you know, yeah. People, what's my buddy from Sean Johnson?
Mm-hmm. Yes. Sean? Yes, I do. Yeah.
He was there and a lot of the who are now popular kirtan singers. And we started doing this every year. You know, my music manager at the time said, you shouldn't do this. He said, why? He said, you're creating your competition. And I said, well, you know, okay, there's something to that, but not really, because the desire to share, once you let that sharing, that process open up, which is also, you know, the such a big part of bhakti yoga is helping others and sharing with others. So I just loved it, and it also brought out different parts of me, you know, teaching and talking. And I made sure, you know, it was like, I'm not a spiritual teacher. I'm just a person, a musician. Yeah. So I have some experience with musician. And then I've had some decades at this point, you know, experience with kirtan. And I can just share things that I've learned and understood, but you know, it might not be right. What seems right to me might not really be right for you. And I understand that. And, you know, one of the beautiful things of bhakti yoga is it's so individual. Mm-hmm. Each person has a different, say, concept of what spirit is, has a different emotional, internal landscape. And a journey. I always say that bhakti yoga is a journey without street signs.
Right. Yes.
And you know, each person has to find their own, make their own map.
Absolutely.
But that being said, we can support each other and help each other on the way. And so then I was, you know, going back to India, kind of every other year, maybe. Mm-hmm. And Maharaji had left his body. Most of the time, I would stay either in or close to Maharaji's temples around India, and the kirtan in his temples, particularly the temple in the mountains near a town called Kenchi, I don't really know what it's like now, but my God, the kirtan there was so beautiful. They hired a group of approximately 20 Bengali singers, and you know, everybody in India knows that Bengal is the heart of the music. Of course, others might argue with that, but you know, there's a quality of devotional music that comes out of Bengal. Ali Akbar Khan was Bengali, and so you know, I would sit with those singers and listen and sing with them, and then I would sing in the temples. Sidi Ma, as an elder woman who passed away, I don't know, I think it was maybe a year or two before the pandemic. Mm-hmm. And it's not like she took Maharaji's place. It wasn't like that. But she took care of the temples, and she took care of the devotees, and not just the Indian devotees, but the Western devotees too. So one time, she asked me to sing a Hanuman Chalisa, which is a 40-verse prayer to Hanuman. Right. She asked me to sing it 11 times in the courtyard with a microphone and everything. Mm-hmm. And I had done that before, and it was a nice thing to do. And, you know, I didn't trip out on it that much. But this particular time, the whole time that I was singing, I felt really self-conscious. You know, I was like the only Western guy there. There was a couple of other Western women. Oh, and Ezra was there. So we were two Western guys, but Ezra was little. And so I didn't feel really good. I didn't feel the flow. I didn't feel my groove. Mm-hmm. But I did it, you know, and every afternoon when I was done, Sidi Ma would say, "That was so beautiful, Jay." She called me Jay Gopal. Because mm-hmm. Gopal is my full Indian, Jay Gopal is my full Indian name.
Right.
And so at the end of the week, I went to her and I said, "Ma, I just have to tell you, I feel like a little bit of a fraud, mm-hmm. you know, because you're saying it was so beautiful. And of course that makes me feel good, but I wasn't feeling anything." And she said to me, "Jay Gopal, what does it matter what you're feeling?" And I was like, "What?" She said, "You're doing your service. This is your service to your guru. This is your service, your gift to all the people who come in and out of the temple. And with the loudspeakers, this is your service to everybody in the valley." And I said, "Well," and then she said, "You know, many of you Americans think that service, seva, is eating an Indian sweet and blissing out under a tree." And she said, for us, seva is often filled with hard work and sometimes worry. And, mm-hmm. and she said, "You know, people who hear your singing, their souls are touched. So whether you know it or not, you're singing from your soul, or that wouldn't happen." It was an amazing and not so easy to assimilate teaching.
Mm-hmm.
It's something that I still occasionally, while I'm singing, I talk to myself. Say I'm not like in the 100%
right.
flow.
Yeah.
I hear her voice and she said, I hear her saying, "Well, what does it matter what you're feeling? You're doing your service." Mm. And, you know, with my albums, I started to get emails and letters from people saying how my music had helped them so much through really, really dark times and had been a support for them and for their heart. And at first I was like, "How's that possible? I feel like my music is very sad. How could it?" Because I was sad, you know.
Right.
How could it be helping anyone? And but gradually, instead of those things going over my head, they started entering my heart. And mm-hmm. I realized that when you share your heart fully, in any aspect of life, but in my case, you know, through singing and through playing music, when you share your heart fully, all the sides of your heart, you know, all the colors, all the moods, it, it's not only healing for yourself, it's healing for others.
Right. And because people can connect to that feeling that you brought out or brought in to the music.
Yeah. And I began to get much less shy about singing. It was a slow process. And I still sometimes, well, not sometimes, I still often have kind of stage fright, you know, mm-hmm. even if it's in a yoga studio and the stage is just a blanket.
Right.
But you know, that feeling of being vulnerable and naked in front of people you don't know, but it passes very quickly, and I offer it to God. You know, mm-hmm. Okay, I got these critical voices going, and you know, fine, I've heard you all before, and let me do what I have to do. You know what I mean?
And yes, absolutely. I think that is part, as you said, of the bhakti practice, right? You're not only offering the good and positive and uplifting emotions that we all like to have, but you're yeah. offering all of it, the worries, the fears, the doubts, the anger, or whatever it might be that comes up.
Yeah, and being completely authentic, or as much mm-hmm. as you can be. It's funny you say anger, you know, it's true. I don't express anger to the audience, even though sometimes I am a little irritated at the audience at times, I don't go there. But I sometimes find while I'm singing, you know, in kirtan, as you know, we're repeating mm-hmm. mantras, and the music changes a lot from the beginning to the end, but the mantra stays the same. So there's this repetition. And it's almost like a churning, right?
Right, yeah.
And there's times that I'm singing and suddenly, I don't know where it comes from, there's this anger. And I just put it into my singing. Uh-huh. Suddenly, I sing really strong at that moment. And then, well, then the next moment it's something else, you know? Uh-huh. Uh-huh. And you know, at this later stage in my life, I'm really like exploring singing softly, because you know, when I was first started singing and I was so shy about my singing, somehow I found that singing really loud and strong mm-hmm. took me past the self-criticism. So yeah. So I did that for a very long time, and it was very, it worked for me, really, you know, and it's beautiful. But then, you know, maybe two decades ago, maybe, I don't know, I started feeling like, well, that's one color. Mm-hmm. And so I started to try to sing really gently. And so that kind of took me back to the beginning as far as you know, the being afraid of being so vulnerable, because when I sing gently, you know, my voice tremors a little, and the insecurity and the weak feeling, I guess, you know, right. that I had wanted to hide by singing really strong. It's not like I conceptualized that, but in retrospect, I saw that.
Yeah,
yeah. Mm-hmm. So now, even now, I love it. I'm learning to sing very gently, and you know, then you know, when the moment comes, then I sing really strong, and that's an amazing feeling. But it's also an amazing feeling to find that really tender side, and these are all, you know, sometimes you can think about what is it in the Bible or something. It says, in my master's house there are many rooms, you know, in the castle of the heart there are many chambers, and this chamber might be a dark feeling, this chamber might be a light, you know, exuberant feeling, this chamber might be sorrow, this, you know what I mean. And so yeah. I want to, without thinking, but just by letting my emotions flow, I want to put all those colors in my singing. Okay, so then gradually kirtan became very popular, and the yoga studios became a little small, you know? And so we started doing kirtan in larger venues. And then what was happening is the festivals, the kirtan festivals and yoga festivals. And at those festivals, I was again, after so long of doing kirtans with just the tabla player or just, you know, me and one other singer, I kind of brought back my big band musical adventures, because we could do that at the festivals. And gosh, that was so fun. And you know, thousands of people singing kirtan, but, you know, with this reggae, deep reggae grooves, or with a horn section, some, yeah. And okay, that kind of brings us to now. Kirtan is very popular. There are kirtan singers all over the place, and the kirtan festivals are very popular. I find that the, you know, on the big stages and stuff, that kind of overlay with celebrity and devotional practice.
Yeah, yeah.
I don't feel like I'm confused about that. But I'm older, and I would say there was a period, particularly before I got sober, there was a period where I did get confused about that and thought I was something extra special, you know? We're all extra special, but I mean, like, I thought I was a star. Right. And you know, I experienced, you know, the folly of that. But so I see younger people, and maybe not so younger people, struggling. And the ones who are struggling, it's good, you know. But the ones who aren't struggling, in a way, who are completely unaware of some of these issues and are just singing and going like, I'm a star. And so it is, you know, it's, well, I hope that everybody kind of figures it out, because the flip side of it is, you know, how beautiful it is that kirtan is popular. I mean, the practice is so great. It's so deep. It's so accessible, and it's so non-sectarian, I guess you could say. Mm-hmm. You know, it's just so great. So the fact that it is popular, I think is more important and more awesome than, you know, than people's little ego problems.
Yeah, but I can totally see that, and it confuses me too. And I'm also always kind of debating on just what you said, right? It's becoming more popular, and more people are coming. But at the same time, I can sometimes, and I experienced it going to some of those concerts, that something was missing. And maybe I went there already being biased before, but still, as you said, the vulnerability sometimes was lacking. And I feel the same, although I'm getting asked sometimes when I teach a yoga workshop to do a kirtan as well. And sometimes I'm not even sure if I want to do it, so it doesn't become like that concert setting of, you know, someone, they like your voice, okay, great, wonderful. But it should be that mutual experience, as you just described it. It's not you leading it, although, you know, technically you are, and you're sitting there in front of a group, but it's all these other gurus and all the traditions and all the energies of lifetimes that are actually coming together and that are doing the actual work, as you said. And I loved, you know, you took us down that memory lane. And it's wonderful to hear how things came back in like cycles and circles, and you explore deeper and deeper layers, and then leaving some things behind, but then bringing them back later on in a different setup. I think that is so inspiring for all of us, also for people who struggle with their voice maybe, and they think, and they're really devoted, but they feel, I'm not a musician, I don't have technical training, what to do, to just give it a go and find their ways. And also to be patient sometimes. I mean, some things just take time.
Patience is really one of the foundation, beams of spiritual life. Patience, you know, people want it like that, and what often happens with kirtan, what I've seen happen is, you know, people in their very first kirtan experience, they're just so completely lit up, right. And then they get into it, and you know, it becomes dry, and then some people just stop. But like anything in life, that there's phases, it waxes and wanes, and you know, I've sort of come around to feel that the times when I'm feeling my spiritual connection or my music, for me, the music and the spiritual connection are so, you know, together. But right. In the times when I feel that it's dry, because it happens to me, those are the times. Well, two things, you know. One, give it a break for a day, you know, or right. 2 days. But then dig deeper, you know, mm-hmm. light the fire, make the fire hotter. And at the same time, ask, you know, please, please bestow your grace on me, because I'm not feeling it. You know, that sort of helplessness. But yeah, that being said, and it's not just with kirtan, with so many things, with relationships. Gosh, uh-huh. You know, more relationships split up than stay together. And I can never comment on another person's life, what happens. But I find, you know, now being married with Nubia for 25 years, that's a long time, and the depth of our devotion to each other, our affection for each other, our working together and respect, you know, it just gets deeper and deeper and deeper. Mm-hmm. Of course, it's, you know, it's like there's flat areas, and then there's, you know, I think it's just the way life is. Look at the moon. It's full, then it waxes, and then it's not there, and then it gets big again, and it's full again. Why should we necessarily expect that everything's going to be full every minute? What does it matter what you're feeling, Jai Gopal?
Yeah. You know? I think that is really, I mean, that's a great sum up for an advice for everything, to see things as service. And yeah, I mean, we could go on. I think we need another episode to dig deeper into all of these things. But I'm sure, because you're not only going on tour for kirtans, you here and there also in Berlin give workshops on bhakti. And of course, they're not 10 days long, they're a couple of hours long, but still you can give people a glimpse into that feeling and into going deeper into what these practices are and what they entail, and share their magic. And the word magic reminded me of a quote of our common friend Sharon Gannon, who says, repetition forces the magic to arise. And that just came to mind when you said that about repeating things and how a shift in perception can only happen sometimes if you stick with it, even if it gets hard or dry or boring, you know, whatever might happen over time.
Sometimes boring, for sure.
Yeah,
you know, Maritz, and every, as far as I know, every culture that is earth related, goddess related, has practices of repetitive mm-hmm. singing, repetitive drumming, dancing, yeah. and though the words might be, you know, are different, the language is different. Perhaps the melodies are even different, and even the visualization of what spirit is could be different. Uh-huh. But the practices are pretty much the same, and it is that repetition. And what I love is that, you know, music just does something to the heart. It just uh-huh. does. Even, you know, you listen to a nice pop song on the radio, even if you're thinking, oh my God, well, it's just a pop song, but if it's a good one, it still does something to your heart, right?
Yes.
And that combined with the repetition and also the inherent, what I know to be inherent transformational power in the mantras. It's a great formula, I guess you could say.
Well, thank you, Jai, for your time and for sharing those stories. I mean, you summed up, I don't know, 50 plus years into kind of an hour, which is amazing, giving us those also very personal moments, I think, that you shared is always great to also understand, you know, where you're coming from. And I think it is reflected in your music if you listen to your albums and you can see kind of those different phases, which I think is very lovely. So we can't wait to welcome you in Berlin, of course. And if you are in any other city and you're listening to this, please join Jai for his workshops and concerts. I know there are also those Kirtan schools that are happening online. So regardless of where you are, you can join. And thank you, Jai. Thank you so much for your time and your words.
Thank you so much, Maritz. I hope I didn't talk your head off. I'm happy to do this again, you know, before we come in person. There's so many other things to share, but it's just beautiful to be with you for an hour and a little more than an hour. I can't wait to re-meet you in person. Great hanging out with you.
Likewise. Thank you.
Bye-bye.